My Word. A panel game devised by Tony Schreyan and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Powell and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden in a game about words. And here's your chairman, Jack Longland.
We go straight into round one, which tests their vocabulary. Two marks. What's the dictionary meaning of the following words? Frank Muir first. Tintinabulation.
It's the study of the movement of a French comic strip character.
I did not say
Tintinabulation.
I didn't say Tintin. I said Tintinabulation.
It's also known in poetry.
Yes, it is.
Yes, keeping time with a kind of runic rhyme. Mm-hmm. To the tintinnabulation that so musically wells from the bells, 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 bells.
Four will do. Yes, and you haven't...
Means the sound, means tintinnabulation, you know, the sound of bells.
That's what I wanted.
Such as Mr. Betjeman was summoned by.
Yes, but you got the original of it, which is Edgar Allan Poe's poem, Bells. Two marks for tintinnabulation. Anne Scott James now. Obloquy. O-B-L-O-Q-U-Y. Obloquy.
Ob means in opposition to, and
yes.
Loquy means speaking, means sort of cross talk, really.
With the accent on the. In your two words.
I beg your pardon.
You said cross-talk, but could you put the accent on one of those two words?
Cross-talk?
That's what I wanted. Two marks. It means abuse, detraction, speaking ill of somebody, reproachful language, so on. Two marks. Now, Dennis Norden. Throw. T-H-R-O-E. As in the phrase, in the throes of.
Always in the phrase, in the throes of. I've never seen it. A throw. It's like a measle. you know, I suppose in the throes of means when you're well stuck into or when you're suffering the stresses and tensions of struggle and labour. And
that's what I wanted. Anne will know more about this than you, Dennis.
And something you know, it must be dirty.
Yes, that's what I wanted.
Pang.
That's what it originally means. It means a violent pang or spasm or paroxysm, particularly as applied to the pangs of childbirth. And then what Dennis said, used of writers in these throes of composition, comes from the physical to presumably the mental. Two marks it is. Now let us bow. Your word is chimera.
Chimera means a very... is now used to mean a rather disagreeable dream,
yes.
But it originally meant a creature in Greek mythology whom I think Heracles met on a famous occasion. It had three kinds of animal. I think it had the tail of a snake,
yes,
and the body of a lion,
no,
and the head of a goat.
No, try it the other way around. Yeah,
the body of a goat and the head of a lion.
Absolutely right. Well done. That triple fire-spouting monster was what it was originally. That means a goat. And it has become, since then, a bogey or a wild or idle fancy. Two marks again. They're doing very well. Now, at this point, I give Dennis and Frank a quotation to think about for their stories in the last round. And Dennis, yours is April in Paris. And for you, Frank, the more haste, the less speed. And so we go to the second round. Origins and derivations. For two marks, how did the following words or phrases originate or derive? Frank Muir, a fly in the ointment.
Fly in the ointment means a mote, something small, messes up a whole lot of, a whole pan of greasy ointment.
Yes, that's true.
So, in other words, one rotten apple mucks up the whole bell.
Well, stick to the rotten and remember what the phrase was. One rotten...
One rotten fly spoils the broth.
Yes, that's right. Do you remember from first where this phrase first occurs?
It's early, Jack.
Yeah.
Yes. Is it Aesop?
No.
It's a hypothetical question.
It's more
Roman.
No, it's more sort of theological than Aesop.
Bible.
Yes. I'm not going to give you full marks unless you tell me where it comes
You'll
from.
You'll find it in the Bible, in the Old Testament.
Yes, you'll be there. Well, not. it derives from the first verse of the 10th chapter of Ecclesiastes. Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savour. So doth a little folly him that in reputation is for wisdom and honour. And Scott James now. A tabby cat.
Oh, heavens. It comes from Tabitha. Tabby means Tabitha, doesn't it?
You're in the right sort of sector of the compass. It comes from that part of the world, yes. Where they speak Arabic.
Yes, it comes from the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
I think it comes from the Arabic word...
for striped.
Tabby...
Striped is...
Tabby oikipu, which means striped. Stripes of rock, you get.
No, stripes of...
Rainbow.
You're exhibiting them tonight.
I'm what?
You're exhibiting them tonight, the gentleman said. Is it jewellery? Is it some kind of...
No. I'll give you one...
Nothing is striped.
One for trying. Rainbow. It's an Arabic word for a watered silk material... which had stripes through the watering, and it applies to a brownish or greyish cat with dark stripes whose coat, with its wavy effect, looks very much the same as that kind of material.
And it's very difficult.
Mm. I know it's very difficult, too. Dennis Norden, this sounds simple, I don't know what it is, to rein cats and dogs.
You mean, where did it come from? It's the old schoolboy joke about that it's raining cats and dogs. You can tell it's raining cats and dogs because there are poodles in the row. I can only think it's a metaphor or poetic, you know, folk poetry for huge globs of rain coming down that could be as big as or as large as cats and dogs.
I'm going to give you one, because I do believe that's one of the possible explanations, Dennis, that simply there's very large drops of things falling out of the sky. But it's supposed to come from Scandinavian mythology. Cats are supposed to have an abnormal effect on the weather, and if they're nasty enough, they produce rainstorms. Dogs produce high winds. Odin, the storm god, had a dog in order to help him produce high winds. So the two together produce the most terrible kind of rainstorm plus wind, hurricane. So that's how it finishes up.
Might it be, Jack, the old fallacies that live animals rain down from the
earth? Like frogs.
Pliny, yep. So that frogs, yep, and snakes, mm, and had instances, mm, of gigantic haddocks falling in Arkansas or something, and raining cats and dogs. It means a very extreme form of this sort of
thing. I think it's very lucky. One out of two, I feel rather doubtful about that one. Dibbis Power, pandemonium.
Pandemonium? Well, it means an absolute holy uproar, unholy uproar.
That's the present meaning, but how did it come to mean that?
Well, it must have meant all the devils.
And where were they?
Well, they were possibly in Paradise Lost.
Yes.
They were in Paradise Lost.
Yes, but they...
They'd fallen from heaven.
Yes, where'd they go to?
And they went to hell.
They went to part
two. They were just two bears. They went down to the infernal depths.
Yes, they did.
And then they all sort of uproared and screamed and fought.
It's the opposite of the city of Mansell. What I want is a place.
The place? Or just hell? Not hell?
Hell's a large thing.
Hades.
Hades, well, no. A large thing?
Superior part of Hades.
Wait a minute.
That's what I wanted.
The residential part.
I didn't hear what
she said. West one. One and a half again. Pandemonium, it means originally all the demons. Dillis knew that one. But it was used by Milton in Paradise Lost as the name of the principal city. in hell.
Was it now?
The rest were all far to the inland retired, about the walls of Pandemonium City and proud seat of Lucifer. So it is the capital of hell.
Well.
Those all tower blocks then.
I think they went into holes in the ground. I think the other way around.
And probably tower blocks to start with. That's why it's hell.
Now, this round is an odd one. It's about unwanted claims to fame. Each of the following was, in a gruesome sense, a kind of pioneer. For 2 marks, can you please explain why this is so sadly true? We begin with Frank Muir, and his hero is Dr. Crippen.
Is it?
He was a pioneer in a particular sense.
He was the first man to be, the first murderer to be arrested on an ocean liner.
Yes.
Shacked up with a male impersonator.
And how is he detected?
I know you want me to say, by Marconi phone.
Yes.
Or wireless telegraphy.
Absolutely right. You can get your 2 marks. Dr. Crippen is trying to escape by ship to America with his mistress, Ethel Neve, dressed as a boy, and they, by radio, which then just started, sent a message to the ship's captain, and he was put under arrest. Now, M. Scott James, a rather different character for you. The Right Honourable William Huskisson, MP, H-U-S-K-I-S-S-O-N, MP.
Do you say it's unfavourable?
No, he was a pioneer in a rather gruesome sense. It was very unfortunate.
A blind MP called Huskisson, was there not?
Yes, no, that's not it.
Not
no,
him.
No.
I got it wrong.
It was very unfortunate for him indeed.
He died.
He was the first railway
first
shepherd
prime minister to call an election at the wrong time.
listen to Frank. Frank is helping
us. Oh, just say it again. Oh,
say
it again.
I said. unhelpfully, he is the first man to eat a British Railway shepherd's pie.
I think he was the first MP to eat a British Railway shepherd's pie. One of the very first of a long line of MPs
and
whom this has happened after.
And earned the wrong point.
That's it.
And earned the wrong point.
That's it.
I packed it in. I've never heard of the man.
Well, half a mark for your effrontery. he was the MP for Liverpool. He was president of the Board of Trade and Colonial Secretary at different times. And if I remember rightly, I'm a great enemy of Wellington's. At the opening of the Liverpool to Manchester Railway, he had the unique honour and privilege of being the first person ever to be run over and killed by a steam locomotive. Well, now it's Dennis Norden's turn. Frederick Louis, or Louis, L-O-U-I-S, eldest son of George II. Now, how was he unique in his misfortune?
Is that Here Lies Fred?
Yes.
Is it?
Yes, quite right.
Well, he was unique in that he was only perpetuated in history by a bit of doggerel.
I don't think that's true, even of monarchs. I mean, I think there must be more.
Well, there's a bit of doggerel that goes, here lies Fred, who was alive and is dead. Had it been his sister, no one would have missed her. Had it been his brother, two are better than the other. Had it been his father, everyone would rather. The whole of his generation would it be better for the nation, but here lies Fred, is alive and is dead, and it's all to be said. It's something...
Well done.
More or less. No, it isn't, no. It's of that order, and he died in an extraordinary way, which I can't remember now, but he died in a most humiliating...
Yes, he did.
..way.
Almost on the playing fields of Eton, but it wasn't quite.
Yeah, that's right. He was hit with a cricket ball.
That's it.
Yeah.
I'm going to give a bonus mark for knowing that poem. 3 marks. Now, Dennis Powell, Thomas Montacute, or de Montacute, or you can call him if you like, Thomas Montague.
You call him Thomas Montague.
4th Earl of Salisbury. What happened to him?
He died.
Yes. No. Suddenly, yes.
They all do.
He died.
I don't think we should discuss it further.
We knew
very
all
lamentable.
We knew all the others. He died. Oh, dear.
He
swallowed something accidentally.
He couldn't have done it. It was too big.
Too big. A cannonball.
That's what I wanted.
A cannonball.
He was the first man to...
To be...
That's it.
Hit by a cannonball.
Rendered breathless.
Some people say that he was the first Englishman to be killed by a cannonball. I think it's unlikely because cannonballs have been invented about 100 years before. But at the Battle of Tourelle, which is a little fort on the end of a bridge, he was ill-advisedly looking out of a little window, and a big stone cannonball came right in at the window and killed him. So his first English general, I think, to be killed by a cannonball.
Do you remember that Marx Brothers film where the cannonball comes through the window into the room and Groucho pulls the blind down?
That's right. But they're similar on this occasion, I think. Anyway, 1.5. Well, now we come to the last round. And we go back to those quotations I gave Denison Frank at the beginning of the program. And on this occasion, the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And if you remember, Dennis, your quotation is April in Paris.
I'm not likely to get it, Jack, because I'd like to use the opportunity afforded by this quotation to make an urgent recommendation to the authorities responsible for running the London Zoo in Regent's Park. Gentlemen, did you happen to see a programme that was on television the other night called Animal Courtship? There was one scene showing a couple of black-capped gulls perpetuating their species, and the reason why that stuck in my mind is I never realised that they did it while actually up in the air in flight. You know, it made me revise my whole opinion about a certain story that an Alitalia pilot I know tells about one of his air hostesses. Gentlemen of the London Zoo, let me come to the reason why I'm drawing this program to your attention. What happened was, instead of the program being put out at its scheduled time of Sunday afternoon, its transmission was switched to 9:25 at night. Why? So that children wouldn't see all the goings-on among the animals. Now, gentlemen of the London Zoo, does that give you food for thought? Because I can tell you this, it certainly should. And I speak as one who recently, fool that I am, thought I'd give my 2 12-year-old nephews an educational afternoon by taking them round your zoo on a warm spring day. And I very quickly learnt something. You know how films have to be labelled in categories ranging from suitable for all the family to no children allowed to see it under any circumstances? Well, so should those cages of yours. And your animals. If the giraffes and the penguins can be described as Mary Poppins, I'll tell you this. That monkey house is Last Tango in Paris. I'm particularly thinking, or trying not to think, about those apes of yours. If apes are the species that Tarzan grew up with, it's no wonder he turned out to be a swinger. I don't know what the spectacle did to those 2 12-year-old nephews of mine, but if their wisdom teeth aren't through now, they never will be. So, gentlemen of the London Zoo, my recommendation is that at your entry gate, you henceforth issue a small booklet to any adult going in with children, a booklet which categorizes each group of your inhabitants according to their embarrassment quotient. From my own experiences of the various species, I can make just three suggestions to start you off. Giraffe will delight. Penguin will enchant. But, and here I draw on Mr. Vernon Duke's immortal melody, ape will embarrass.
I ought to have added that the popular song April in Paris, written in 1932, had music by Vernon Duke and lyrics by a chap called E.Y. Harburg. And now we go on to Frank and his story. And this, if you remember, was a proverb: the more haste, the less speed.
It's Animal Week this week, here on My Word, and it's Answer to Correspondence Week, as far as I'm concerned, on this side of the house. Now, as you can probably imagine, we get a lot of correspondence in from overseas about this program. Only about 5 weeks ago, another air letter poured in. It was from a Mrs. McNamara in Perth, Australia. And Mrs. McNamara said that, reminded me that all over a year ago, about 18 months ago, I'd explained that our Afghan had puppies, and I'd kept one. And Mrs. McNamara said, can you give us a progress report on your puppy? How is it, you know, are they expensive to keep? How do you manage with the carpets, bringing up an Afghan puppy and so forth? So I thought I'd take this in the next 30 or 40 minutes in answering that letter. Well, the puppy is fitting well. 2 years ago, 2 years old last week. She's, her name is Lady Ottoline Mole. And in keeping with a name like that, she's 2 inches taller than her mother and weighs 4.5 stone. She loves her little dog basket, absolutely adores it. She eats about 1/2 inch of it per night. And she's now completed the second, and we've got her onto a dog nest, which is a kind of bag filled with tiny plastic beans. I don't know whether you know, Mrs. McNamara, but Afghans dig. They are diggers. For instance, you'll find no record of an Afghan being kept in Colditz. The reason being that no commandant could keep an Afghan in Colditz long enough to get its name and kennel number. I would give a lazy Afghan 32 minutes to dig out of Colditz. This was born home on us when the puppy was about a year, and couldn't see it in the garden, didn't bother, you know, probably harbouring under a rose bush. About late morning, phone call. Mr. Muir, I said, yes. He said, are you the owner of a pale gold Afghan, dark muzzle and ears? And I said, yes. He said, I am the signalman at Egham Hive Level Crossing. So I said, have you seen my dog? He said, yes, sir. I'm looking at it now. I said, where is it? He said, well, sir, it is preceding the 10:40 from Waterloo on the down line. But there you are, you know. It's sheep ties, you know, the girl sheep ties. She knows the difference between indoors and outdoors. She knows that in one, she can dance about, leap about, do whatever she needs to do in privacy. And in the other place, it's the place for being quiet and sleeping. The trouble is, she doesn't know which is which. So on the question of carpets, we did have trouble initially. And then, you know, whenever you turned your back, there'd be a 9 by 5 inch grey map of Corsica silently sinking into the pile. And the curious thing, that once the 9 by 5 inch map of Corsica is there, it's a dog's fervent wish to keep it fresh and replenish it every hour. And then start a reserve Sardinia by the radiator. We have a lady who comes in and cleans for us called Mrs. Hayes, and she's a terrific, goes through the house like a tornado twice a week. And Mrs. Hayes is particularly proud of the carpet. And then when Mrs. Hayes went away for 3 months to visit her son in Australia, there were mats, of course, that got all over the carpet. Then when Mrs. Hayes came back and started scrubbing and cleaning twice a week, again, the dog wasn't interested. This is quite logical, actually. Apparently, there's a sort of smell thing. You know, they like to return to the depository. It's happier on a previous smell. So, really, we've got it licked now because Mrs. Hayes is back and working away twice a week. So the answer to your major question, Mrs. McMahon, what about the carpets, bringing up an Afghan, is quite simple. As far as our carpets are concerned, the more hazed, the less peed.
And by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Frank Buer wins the story contest, and he and his teammate, Dillis Powell, also win the entire contest of this evening's My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Buer, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, with questions compiled by Peter Moore. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC.